Okay, so this is bio 231, and this is the second week of school. It's January 30th, and we're going to finish up the cell chapter today. So are there any questions over what we covered so far in the class? Or any questions with Blackboard? So everybody should have been able to log into Blackboard already, and the deadline for the first week, which was a really, really short week, is tomorrow. And then also the deadline for week number two is tomorrow at 11 p.m., which is going to be this cell chapter. All right, so those two things. Hopefully you realize it's not too difficult to get those online quizzes done, so you can get way ahead in the class even if you want to. I didn't check to see how people are doing, but did anybody have trouble logging into Blackboard and taking a quiz yet? Okay. You can even do the forever quizzes, the one that has the postage stamp on it. You can do the forever quizzes from now to the end of the semester, and probably you want to play around with those, or if you have not already. There's no deadline for those, and those are worth course points. All right, so last time, am I rushing anybody? Anybody thinking of a question? No? Good. So everybody's registered. Wonderful. So here we have, on the right-hand side, no, it's your left-hand side, we've got a picture of a cell, and I want you to be able to recognize these organelles inside the cell and then have a little idea of what these organelles are doing inside the cell. Like, for instance, what do we got right here? It's not too difficult because I didn't erase the labels right here, but that is, don't look at the labels, just look at the organelles. That's mitochondria. Now, here's something that's not on the slide. What is this mitochondria doing? Making ATP, energy for the cell, right? Here, what is this organelle right here? Rough ER. What's the job of rough ER? Protein synthesis. Here is smooth ER, and what's its job? Makes lipids. Yeah, makes lipids. Here is a ribosome, a free ribosome, not associated with rough ER. And what's its job? What's the job of a ribosome? Again, it is for protein synthesis. That's the workbench for making a protein. This is where amino acids come from around the cytosol. Amino acids are put together to make a protein on this little workbench that we call a ribosome. And because rough ER has ribosomes, rough ER can make proteins out of amino acids. All right, Golgi apparatus. It's a part of the secretory pathway. So what are two words that describe what the Golgi apparatus does? Packages and modifies proteins, right? So it gets proteins from the rough ER, modifies them, packages them in vesicles, and those vesicles maybe stay inside the cell, but usually it's part of the secretory pathway, so these products then are secreted from the cell. Okay, so those are a bunch of organelles, and we talked about microtubules and centrioles, all the different organelles, lysosomes. Remember, a lysosome is an intracellular digestive system. We talked about all these different kinds of organelles inside the cell. And remember, everything to the interior of the cell membrane is cytoplasm, and cytoplasm has two main components. We can break cytoplasm down into two things. What are the two things that cytoplasm can be categorized into? Cytosol, number one, cytosol, that's the fluid part inside the cell. And second thing, organelles, right, like mitochondria. And then some organelles are membrane-bound, like mitochondria, endoplasmic reticulum. It means it has a membrane around them. Other organelles do not have a membrane, like microtubules, microfilaments, and centrioles right here don't have a membrane around them. So that's another way that we can talk about organelles. Oh, here's something else maybe I didn't mention, a peroxisome. That's another kind of vesicle. So here we see a secretory vesicle, another vesicle with a lysozyme, lysosome that contains lysozyme. Lysozyme is a digesting enzyme. It breaks things down. And then peroxisome, here's another vesicle called a peroxisome. This one is for detoxification. It can detoxify harmful chemicals that are in the cytosol because it contains a chemical called peroxidase, kind of almost similar to hydrogen peroxide, or it's a chemical that breaks down hydrogen peroxide that the cell kind of builds up at certain times. Have you ever used hydrogen peroxide? Like if you cut yourself, you pour some hydrogen peroxide on that wound and it bubbles up, and you have enzymes, namely peroxidase, which breaks hydrogen peroxide down into water and oxygen. Both are very helpful compounds to have in your body. It kills bacteria and it kind of scrubs the wound out at a microscopic level, and it helps prevent infection, hydrogen peroxide. So that's kind of handy. Well, some of you are wondering, why are all of these organelles inside the cell? And it's probably a pretty good idea to be able to have an understanding of why a cell has all these different organelles. Anybody have any ideas? Why does a cell, at least a really nice, fancy, sophisticated cell like what makes our body up, has all of these organelles? Bacteria don't have organelles. Okay, they're not as sophisticated. So why do we have all these organelles right here? It takes a lot of energy to build them. Why is that? Well, we see that they have different shapes, which then means they have different functions, right? So all these organelles have different functions. But the reason, the big reason why our cells have organelles is because each of these different functions, like the production of ATP, might inhibit protein synthesis if they were occurring together, right? Or it might inhibit lipid synthesis. So think of this cell right here as being this building. And let's just say you walk into this building, the SEM building, and it didn't have rooms. So think of rooms as being organelles. If you walked in and it was one big amphitheater, one big huge room, what would that be like? My first thought, oh wow, that could be pretty cool, because I could walk into this one building with just one room, and I could take a physics class, I could take a math class, and an anatomy class, and a geology class all at the same time, and I could get a degree in one semester. Would that work? Could you listen to like five or six lectures at one time? No, it would be a really big mess. So what do you do with a building where you like to have all these things going on at the same time? Put some rooms in the building. So what we do in here doesn't interfere with the biology class that's next door, right? And the chemistry labs that are upstairs, right? So a building is broken down into rooms where special functions can take place without interfering with other functions that are taking place in the building at the same time. The same thing for organelles. Think of these organelles as rooms in a building, and there's special functions that are taking place, and when a mitochondria is doing its job, it can do its job without interfering with what a lysosome is doing, or a peroxisome, or endoplasmic reticulum. Right? So it allows for different layers of specialization, and so that these different functions don't interfere with each other. That's really important. Because what were to happen if all this lysozyme wasn't contained in a lysosome? What would happen? Then that lysozyme would digest the inside of the cell, right? So different functions happen with these different organelles so that they don't, those functions don't interfere with each other. I don't know if that's my phone. Is that my phone? No, it's not my phone. Okay, turn your phones off, you guys, when you come in here. So that's something important. Okay, nuclear structures. Let's just stay with this slide right here. Okay, here is the nucleus inside the cell. It's the contains genetic material, and the form of genetic material is DNA. That's the basic form of genetic material, DNA. And then DNA is arranged into chromosomes, and we got 46 chromosomes that make up a human cell. And just like the, what's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. DNA has a building block as well, and that's called a it's called a nucleic acid. Oh, guess what? I don't want you to know that. Okay? A nucleic acid makes DNA, but the building block would be a nucleotide. Yeah, I don't want you to know that. All right, so here are where the chromosomes, and they're protected from everything in the cytosol and the rest of the organelles because it's behind a membrane right here. I see a dark spot inside the nucleus. That's the active part of the nucleus, and you got to know what that's called. What's that called? The nucleolus. If you want to say nucleolus, that's fine. Right? Just make sure you know that's a little bit different than the nucleus. That's the most active part. And the chromosomes are made out of material that we call chromatin. Now I do want to go to another slide. So let me find chromatin. Oops. sorry, this one here, chromatin. Okay, so here we see DNA. Okay, and the building blocks are these different nucleotides, which you can't see on this slide. And you see it kind of looks like a step ladder right here, and it forms these different coils. Right? And when DNA is being used, it's in this form that we see right here, which is what we call extended chromatin. There's very few coils, and there are no proteins. There are very few proteins associated with it. And this is a very thin thread, and it's relatively fragile. It's easy to break. When it breaks, then the information is lost, and that results in the death of the cell. But this is the kind of DNA that can be used to make proteins. We call it extended chromatin. And then when the DNA is not being used, look what happens. It starts to coil around some proteins. These proteins are what we call histones, so it wraps around like thread on a bobbin. And then there's some more wraps that form, and then these wraps then form coils. And then these coils even form super coils. It gets bunched up, and then soon it becomes so thick that light can't even pass through it, and you can see it underneath the microscope. So on one end of this diagram, we see extended chromatin, which is really thin and long. And on the other end, we see condensed chromatin. Hi. Oh, yeah. Can you see me at 3 o'clock or no? Are you busy? You have? Oh, okay. Okay, I'll look at this. Maybe I can call you. Okay, thank you. Okay, so on one end you see extended chromatin, on the other you see condensed chromatin. And when it's condensed, we can actually see it underneath the microscope, right? And it forms a chromosome. Just to give you an idea of how long these molecules are, right? Microscopically thin, but if we were to add up all the chromosomes in your body and stretch them from end to end, they would reach 250,000 miles on a typical person. That's from here to the moon. And it's microscopically thin, so you can imagine how easy it would be to break a chromosome, right, and then the cell would die as a result of that. So these histone proteins allow chromatin to be wrapped up into a chromosome, so it's nice and safe and protected when it's in a condensed form, and when it's in an extended form, it can be easily damaged. When it's in a condensed form, the information can't be used to make proteins, right? So it's safe but can't be used. In order to use it to run your cell, it's got to be in extended form. The trade-off there is that that's when it can be most easily damaged. All right, so that's the two kinds of chromatin that makes chromosomes: condensed, which is safe, and extended, which is relatively fragile. There are holes in the plasma membrane that we call pores, nuclear pores. And if we go back to that first slide, okay, we can see the nuclear pores. So I can see some nuclear pores in the membrane. So sometimes DNA is copied into a form that is used in the cytoplasm, and that copied form of the DNA can leave the nucleus via these pores and can start protein synthesis in the cytoplasm. Okay. So that's one way material can move through a membrane, is through these pores. There's another way that material can move across membranes. That's the next topic that we're going to talk about. And there are two processes, right? There's passive transport, and the second is active transport. Passive just means that it's going to happen automatically, right? It's just a physical process of the universe that we live in. Things will just move according to a concentration gradient. For instance, if I have a perfume bottle right here in the front of the room, if I open up the cap on the perfume bottle, it evaporates into the air, and even though there's no wind blowing in, there's no fan moving air around inside the room, that perfume is going to move from a high concentration near the bottle to low concentration. And where's the lowest concentration going to be at? Way in the back of the room. So that perfume is just going to move from the bottle to the back of the room. So guess who's going to smell it first? People in the front row. Who's going to smell it second? People in the second row, and then the third and fourth, and it's just going to move to the room, throughout the whole room. And if we were to sit here overnight, okay, we're going to smell the same perfume in the back of the room as in the front of the room. There's going to be an equal concentration of perfume no matter where you're sitting. And that's what we call diffusion. Think molecules will just evenly distribute themselves and fill in any low concentration spots anywhere that might happen in the room. Okay, that does not require energy, and it moves from high concentration to low. So that's a pretty important concept, high concentration to low. Things won't automatically go from low concentration to high. That can't happen without energy. There are two ways that we talk about a passive process. One is diffusion, like we just talked about. A second is osmosis, and osmosis will help us understand what's happening inside the cell. Osmosis is a form of diffusion, but not exactly the same. Right? There are three criteria that will make diffusion of a molecule osmosis. So I'm going to put those three criteria on the board. Okay, so first, diffusion. All right, so a question I have, is diffusion active or passive? Passive. Okay, then we're going to define what that term is. So we're going to say passive. All right, so that's number one. And number two is osmosis. Let me try another marker. That's pretty good, but maybe I got a better one still. Osmosis. Osmosis is diffusion, so that means that it is passive. And when we say passive, does not require energy. And the criteria, number one, the molecule that's moving can only be H2O. What's H2O? Water, right. Okay, so the molecule that's moving is water in order for it to be osmosis. It can't be a sugar molecule, can't be protein or lipid. Okay, the second criteria is that it's got to move through a membrane, and a special kind of membrane, semi-permeable. I'm running out of marker again. Semi-permeable membrane. Semi-permeable just means that it allows some things to go across it, but not others. So a semi-permeable membrane will let water move across it, but not other kinds of molecules, like proteins or sugar molecules, for instance. Okay, so that first example where I opened up a perfume bottle and it just diffused through the whole room, could we call that osmosis? You're saying no, and I'd like your answer, because when perfume is moving through the room, it's not moving through any kind of membrane, much less a semi-permeable membrane. So since it's not moving through a membrane, it can't be osmosis. And since it's the perfume model that's molecule that's moving, it's not water, so again, it can't be osmosis. It has to be only the water molecule and through a semi-permeable membrane. Oh, don't forget this E right here. Okay. And then the third thing, it's got to be diffusion, a passive process. And how does diffusion work? How does a molecule move by diffusion? From where to where is it going to move? From high concentration to low concentration. Okay? So it's got to be diffusion only, which means high to low, just like that. Okay. So if it agrees with all of these principles right here, then it is osmosis. If it doesn't, then it's some other kind of process. Can't be osmosis. Maybe it's just simple diffusion. All right, so that's an important way that the cell can take up material from outside to the inside. Okay, the second process that I have right here is active transport. It requires energy. All right, what does the cell use for energy? It uses ATP. Where does that come from? Mitochondria, right? So when we say active, we mean it uses up ATP that mitochondria make for us. But in this circumstance, right? It's using up energy, but it can do something special. It can move molecules from low concentration to high concentration. Like, think of that perfume bottle again. Okay? We got a perfume bottle, and where do we find the highest concentration of perfume bottle? In the air around the room or inside the bottle? It's inside the bottle is the highest concentration. Okay? So is it possible to take a molecule at low concentration in the air and put it in the bottle where it's high concentration? Is that allowed? Without energy, it happens. The reverse process. It goes from the bottle to the air, fills up the whole room. But can we take that perfume from the room and stick it back in the bottle? You know what? We can if it's an active process, not in a passive process. It's going to take some machinery and energy to grab that perfume molecule and stick it in the bottle. Otherwise, guess what? We'd never have a bottle with perfume in it, right? We could never have a bottle with perfume if there wasn't some way to get perfume going from low concentration to high concentration. But to do that, what do you need? You need energy to make that happen. It won't happen automatically. The reverse process happens automatically. So for active transport, things can move from low to high as long as ATP is available to make it happen. And then we have to have some mechanism to do that. But remember, in the plasma membrane, there are all kinds of special protein molecules that can look, that can act as channels and transporters that can actually grab a molecule, take it from low concentration and put it in high concentration inside the cell. As long as that protein has ATP, where's my cursor? Here it is. As long as that protein has ATP available, it can do its job and move molecules from outside to inside or from low to high concentration. Okay, that's what we call molecular transport. You also have macromolecular transport, like phagocytosis, right? There are two terms. Exocytosis is the process where something is inside the cell and then it moves over and is released outside the cell. Like secretion is exocytosis, right? And under what category is exocytosis? Passive or active transport? It's active transport because it requires energy to move these vesicles around. It requires energy to package these vesicles, and it requires some energy to have these vesicles fuse with the plasma membrane to release these products. So that requires ATP, so that's an active process. That's what we call exocytosis. The reverse of that process is taking material from the outside of the cell, right? And then the cell membrane is going to form a dimple, right, and then a bigger dimple and then a pocket so the material enters. So this material is going to enter this vesicle, right? Then the shape of the vesicle is going to get, it's going to pinch away from the cell membrane. This opening is going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. Then finally, this material is now inside the cell. So it's going from outside to inside right here. This is what we call endocytosis. Endocytosis is the opposite of exocytosis. And there are two ways that we talk about endocytosis. If it is a particle, like these substances right here, okay, are solid particles, we call it phagocytosis, is a special form of endocytosis. And phagocytosis just means literally cell eating. So the cell, think of this as like being jaws on the cell, it's just grabbing material on the outside and bringing it to the inside of the cell. So even large macromolecules. If that same process occurs, right, so that only there is fluid being engulfed by this vesicle and not solid particles, we call it pinocytosis. So pinocytosis and phagocytosis are similar in that they import material to the inside of the cell. Pinocytosis is for fluids and phagocytosis is for solid material. So there's some little distinctions right here. All right, what's another way that phagocytosis and pinocytosis are the same? What's another way that they're similar? They're different because one's for particles, the other's for liquid, but how are they the same? Okay, the cell is ingesting it. I like that. Yeah, one's eating, one's drinking, so both are endocytosis, bringing in. What's another way that they're similar? That you could say that again? Yeah, they're both active transport. They require ATP. right? They require energy. So that's another way they're similar. And another way they're similar is that they require vesicles in order for that to happen. The manipulation of this vesicle. And these membranes move around because they're connected to microfilaments inside the cell, which attach to proteins in the membrane right here that can pull and pull on the membrane and cause it to deform and change shape. And that's all controlled by the cell. All right, so that's how things can move across the plasma membrane. Usually only helpful substances are brought into the cell, the things that cells need to stay healthy, like nutrients or building blocks to make things. And things that are released are harmful chemicals. Okay? And so the cell membrane can determine which way things move. Okay, so that's moving across the cell membrane. Protein synthesis. Let's talk a little bit about protein synthesis. Okay, and a protein is one of the few kinds of biological compounds that your cell makes a lot of. So proteins is one thing. Anybody have a guess what maybe some other important chemical compounds, biological compounds your cell makes that it needs? I'll give you a hint. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Yeah, lipids. Your body needs lipids. As a matter of fact, lipids make up all cell membranes, all membranes. This is a phospholipid. Okay, so it's probably sooner or later you're going to have to know the building block for these different compounds. Okay, so the building block for a protein is amino acid. Okay, the building block for fat are fatty acids. That's one way to think of it. Okay, but let's talk about protein synthesis. So what do you need to make a protein? Another way of asking, what's the building block of a protein? Amino acids. So we want to make a protein, we got to put amino acids together. Okay, how does this happen and what controls, how does the cell know how to put amino acids together to make a protein? That information is contained in DNA, which is contained in chromosomes, which can be found where? Inside the nucleus right here, right? Okay. Now we said if that DNA were to become damaged, what would happen to the cell? It would die, right? And then, so the cell wouldn't know how to make proteins or anything like that, okay? So there is a way that we look at protein synthesis, and this is how we looked at it maybe when I was in school decades ago. Okay, this is what we call the central dogma in biology. This is just something we believe in. Back then, we were taught this, and we were taught never to question this dogma. Just something that you were supposed to believe and never question because this is how reality is. All right. Well, what do you know about science? If you really study science and you're taught something, what are you supposed to do? Question. Always question it, right? Always question it because, well, you're supposed to question authority all the time. But don't get carried away, okay, with that. So this is a good place to start. Here's the central belief about biology, right? And DNA contains information, all right? It contains information on how to build proteins and then how the proteins work inside the cell. So we have this information contained in DNA, and then it's converted into RNA, and then it's converted into a protein. Okay. So how many step process does it take to take DNA and convert it into a protein, according to this diagram that I have on your slide? How many steps? Another way of asking, how many arrows are there? Okay. I see one arrow, and then I see two arrows. So it takes two steps. So the first step is converting information from DNA into RNA. The second step is converting RNA into proteins right here. Now take a look at these arrows. Is this a one-way arrow or a two-way arrow? One-way arrow. So this is the central dogma in biology. Information always flows from DNA, which is inside the nucleus, into RNA, and then into a protein. And that protein then helps your living processes inside the cell. Okay? And it can never go backwards. Proteins, for instance, that we consume in our diet can't end up and modify the chromosomes that are inside your nucleus, right? According to the central dogma of biology. And that's still true as far as we know today. And that's really handy. Why is that a really good thing? I'm relieved to hear that. Why is that a really good thing? Because tonight when you go home and have a nice chicken dinner, you don't have to worry about waking up in the morning with a beak and feathers. Right? Because those chicken proteins that you eat can't change who you are because of this flow of information. It's a one-way street. Right? Okay. All right, so information in DNA always flows from DNA into proteins and never the reverse, right? DNA directs the production of proteins. Proteins do not control or direct the production of DNA or chromosomes inside your body, right? So you're pretty much you throughout your whole lifetime. All right, but we said this is a two-step process. We got to know the names of these two steps. This first step right here is what we call transcription. The second step is what we call translation. Now, those terms seem very similar, but maybe if you're not really familiar with them, you can look them up in the book, but we're going to talk about them a little bit. Okay, transcription. You're familiar with that term because guess what a student just gave me right here? This is an official copy of all of their grades that they from the courses that he took here on campus. Okay, what do you call this thing? It's a transcript. That sounds a whole lot like transcription, right? Transcript is a noun. Transcription is a process of making it. Okay. How do you make a transcript of something? What is a transcript? Say, okay, you have your textbook like that right there, and I want a copy of that textbook. I say, okay, by tomorrow morning, I'd like a copy of your textbook. What would you do? Okay, years ago, you'd have to sit down on a table with a candle and a little feather and a well of ink and start, what? Copying, exactly, drawing all the diagrams, right? So a transcript is an exact duplicate of some book or paper someplace, right? And you're just making another copy of it. But today, what would we do? Just make a photocopy of it. So a transcript is a photocopy of the original information. Is it the exact... It's exact copy. It's not the information. It's just a copy, exact copy of the information. All right. So RNA is a copy of the DNA. It contains the same information. The building block is just a little bit different. Right. Okay. So transcription is making a copy of DNA into RNA. The DNA never gets changed. Now, where does that happen? It happens inside the nucleus right here, behind the nuclear envelope, because in order to make RNA, condensed chromatin has to be converted into extended chromatin, which is the form which can be damaged very easily. Right. And then that RNA leaves the nucleus going through the nuclear membrane right here, maybe through a nuclear pore. Right. And so RNA can leave the nucleus and enter the cytoplasm. And in the cytoplasm, it can be used to make a protein, or it might be damaged, right? If that RNA is damaged, is that such a terrible thing? Not necessarily so terrible, because the DNA inside the nucleus is still safe. So the RNA can be damaged, but it can be replaced very easily by what kind of process? What kind of process would replace the RNA that's damaged in the cytoplasm? That would be transcription. The cell would just make another photocopy of it and pass it around through the cytoplasm for whoever wanted to use it. Okay. Okay, so the building block for DNA is a nucleotide. The building block for RNA is a nucleotide. It's the same building block. So it's the same language. The language is a nucleotide language. Right, so just like the transcript that I have right here, the original copy was English. What do we got in here? Is it going to be in a different language? No. It's going to be just a photocopy. It's going to be English, right? Okay. Okay, three kinds of RNA that are made inside the nucleus. We have ribosomal RNA. Sometimes we call that RNA, little r, then capital R, capital N, capital A. That makes ribosomes right over here. That's the workbench for where proteins are made. Another kind is a transfer RNA. Sometimes I think of it as a taxi RNA. Transfer RNA wanders around the cytoplasm. It grabs an amino acid, and it brings it over to a ribosome, so a ribosome can make a protein out of it. That's just a building block. Okay? And then the third kind of RNA is what we call messenger RNA. This is a really long piece of RNA. It kind of matches up with the length of a piece of DNA, and it tells the ribosome in what order to add amino acids together. So there are about 20 different kinds of amino acids. They have to be put together in the right order to make a particular kind of protein. If you change the order of amino acids in a protein, maybe keep the number of amino acids the same, but change the order, you're changing the structure of that protein. Guess what's going to happen? The function of that protein is going to change as well, and it's usually never to the benefit of the organism, right? So the correct order of amino acids have to be maintained to make a protein that functions the way the cell wants it to function. So think of an amino acid as a letter, right? And just think of a word that has five letters in it, right? And depending on the order of the letters determines what the meaning of that word is. And if you scramble the letters around, sometimes you get another word, sometimes you get nonsense, right? In most cases, you get nonsense. So that's what the messenger RNA does. It gives the correct spelling for proteins so they have the proper function. Okay, and a gene is just a sequence of nucleotides in the DNA that contains the proper order for amino acids in a protein. All right, so where does transcription take place? You can analyze this by looking at what is transcription once again. It's converting DNA to RNA. Where do you always find DNA? It's in the nucleus. So transcription has to happen where? Only in the nucleus, because that's the safe place to extend chromatin, right, to convert it from condensed to extended. That's the best place to keep it from breaking. All right, so protein synthesis, let's get back. How many steps does it take? Two. The first one is? Which is making a photocopy of DNA, making RNA out of it. What's the second step called? Translation. That's the second step. All right, so we said RNA leaves the nucleus, and then it forms ribosomes or brings amino acids to a ribosome, or it contains the correct spelling. That's what we call like the messenger RNA. Messenger RNA almost would be like the dictionary RNA, would be another way to think about it. Okay, so translation always happens in the cytoplasm, not the nucleus. Okay, because that's where we have all the rest of the machinery. Now, what the heck is translation? I bet a lot of people know what translation is. Well, you knew what transcription was, now that you think about it. But what is translation? What does translation really mean? I wish I was really fluent in another language, because I would just speak to you. Okay? Okay. Je ne double pas ni. What did I just say? Why'd you say, oh, good morning, in Polish? Nobody speaks Polish, or Russian probably, or any related language. Okay? Well, what would you need to do to understand what I just said? You need to translate, right, from one language to another. And a translator takes information, converts it into another language, but what about the meaning when you translate something? Do you change the meaning of words? No, the meaning is the same, but they sound totally different because you use a different alphabet, you use different pronunciation, right? Or like going from Hindi to Farsi, right? Or from Mandarin to English or something, right? Or Portuguese to Italian. In order to understand, you need a translator to do that. Like the United Nations has all kinds of translators. So translation is the step of converting RNA into a protein because the language is different. The information is exactly the same, but the language is different. What's the language that a protein is made out of? Another way of asking that is, what's the building block of a protein? Amino acids. So amino acids make up proteins, but the language of RNA are nucleotides. So translation is a step of going from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language. So when you go from one language to another, that's translation. Do you change the meaning? Meaning is the same, just a different language. Okay. So that's the two steps that are used to make proteins inside the cell that determine the structure and the function inside the cell. The first one is transcription that happens inside the nucleus. The second is translation that happens in the cytoplasm. But it's always going to be associated with a ribosome, whether it's a free ribosome in the cytosol or a bound ribosome to rough endoplasmic reticulum. And then to review, proteins that are made by rough ER have a fate of leaving the cell. Their destiny is to be secreted. Proteins that are made by free ribosomes don't get secreted. They stay inside the cell. Right? So there's two different pathways, one for secretion and one for staying inside the cell. Okay. So that's what I would like for you to know about protein synthesis. How many steps does it take? Two. First one is photocopying. The second one is translation. So transcription and translation. Which one happens in the cytoplasm? Translation. Which one happens in the nucleus? Transcription. Words are really similar, so you might have to stop and think about how to pronounce it before you say it. But it's not too hard to really realize the difference between transcription and translation. As long as you realize that if the RNA becomes damaged, is that going to cause the death of the cell? No. Because you can get that information again by going to the DNA and just transcribing it once again. Okay. All right, well, in the next decades to come, I'm sure that somebody might discover some processes that can go in the reverse direction. And as a matter of fact, today we know that some viruses do not contain genetic material in the form of DNA. They actually contain genetic material in the form of RNA. Right? The building block is the same. They're both nucleotides, but there are RNA viruses, and when they infect your cells, right, they do have an enzyme that can convert RNA, which is the virus RNA, into DNA, which then becomes part of your genome, your chromosomes. And that's how some viruses take over the machinery inside your cell. And that's called a reverse transcriptase, right? So reverse transcription is a process that happens all the time for some kinds of viruses. We would call that a retrovirus. One that we've become really concerned with over the last 15 years or so is what? The human immunodeficiency virus, or AIDS. It's a virus that produces AIDS. Okay, and the virus itself is not a cell, right? It's still dead because it doesn't have organelles, doesn't have cytoplasm. It just has RNA on the inside. So it's terribly hard to treat because a virus you can't kill because it's not alive, right? So you got to come up with other kinds of interesting treatments to fight viral infections. Like how do you inhibit the reverse transcriptase, for instance, so that it can't really infect your cell. And people are studying all of those kinds of things. Okay, one last bit for this chapter, and that is cell division. We actually looked at this in lab, okay, but it's so important. I think we're going to look at it again. All right, because it's going to be on the practicum, and the Monday lab group has their first practicum, which includes transcription on Monday, a week from today. So, I really don't like those markers because they don't erase very well. All right, so I'm going to use this one here. All right, so mitosis. All right, we start with this thing. So, I don't know, kind of help me out. What is this thing right here? It's going to undergo something that kind of looks like this. It's going to produce two of these things right here, like that, and like that. So what do we call this thing and what do we call those things? Parent cell. Yeah. And these are daughter cells. And not important for this class, but I'll ask anyway. How many chromosomes does this parent cell have? 46. The human has 46 chromosomes inside the nucleus right here. Okay, and inside the nuclei of these two daughter cells, how many chromosomes do we have? We got 46 in both of these. There's 46 here and 46 right here. All right, well, if we split this parent cell into two daughter cells and the two daughter cells have 46, what do we have to do to these 46 chromosomes here? Because if we split these 46, we're going to end up with 23 and 23. What do we got to do? Okay, we got to replicate them or duplicate them. So for instance, here is a chromosome right here. Here's just a single chrome. During interphase, this chromosome is replicated or duplicated. So you have another copy of it connected right here. So a lot of times you see chromosomes kind of looking like an X. That's because there's two copies. So that when mitosis takes place, okay, both daughter cells get the same number of chromosomes because they just separate. So what we're looking at right here is mitosis. So mitosis is a form of reproduction. Okay, and What kind of reproduction is it? Well, look at this cell right here compared to this one here. What's the difference between? What's the shape? Is there any difference in shape? No. What about number of chromosomes? What about color? Any difference in color? No, these cells are exactly the same. These are clones, and they are the same as this parent cell right here. Right? Same number of chromosomes and everything. So this is not sexual reproduction, because we all arise through sexual reproduction. And if you look around the room, you see you anywhere. Do you see another you? No, we're all different. So sexual reproduction produces a difference, right? But asexual reproduction, which is what mitosis is, produces what? Exactly the same kind of cells over and over and over again. Okay, so that's important. What are the two reasons for mitosis? Because at some point in time, we were just a single cell, right? Here's an egg from your mom. Here's a sperm from your dad. They came together through a process called fertilization, right? Because there were 23 chromosomes in this egg, 23 in the sperm. They joined together, right? So you, half of your chromosomes come from your mom, half come from your dad to form this thing that we call a zygote right here. All right, and a zygote is not really fun. Why is a zygote not a really fun stage of life? You can't come to anatomy lecture and take notes or listen or nothing, right? There's no ears here, no eyeballs or nothing, okay? So in order for that to happen, we need mitosis to make more cells. So growth is an important reason for mitosis. And then also in lab, what did we do? We looked at some of your cells. What did we do? How did we get those cells? We scraped them off your cheek, the lining of your cheek, put them on a microscope slide, right? So you're losing cells all the time. Sometimes you scrape them off, you're losing cells from your skin, your clothes rub them off. So another important reason for mitosis is to replace cells that die of old age, or they rub off, or you sample them to look at them in a microscope, or they suck a bunch out because you need a blood test or something. Who knows? A lot of reasons why you lose cells. And you don't want to get smaller and smaller and smaller your whole life. You want to stay the same, right? So mitosis is important to replace. All right. But mitosis doesn't happen just in the snap of a finger. It's a multi-step process. The DNA is replicated in a phase called interphase. That's the normal growth phase of the cell cycle. Interphase. That's not active mitosis. That's just a growth phase. So that if we have five mitochondria in this cell, those mitochondria are going to divide and make 10 mitochondria so that both of these cells get five mitochondria. Okay? If there is one pair of centrioles in this cell, those centrioles replicate themselves so that you get one pair of centrioles in both of these cells right here. Right? So interphase is a growth phase, and that's the phase where the cell is going about doing its everyday job. All right, and then what are the phases of mitosis when the cell is ready to divide? Right? Yeah, prophase, okay, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. We went over that. That kind of spells out IPMET, so you got to know the correct sequence. And then you should be appreciative of some things that are happening during those different phases of mitosis and what they look like. One last thing. Telophase, telo means end or the tip of something, also has a process taking place within telophase, and that is cytokinesis, right? So in your slide notes, you see telophase with cytokinesis. And what the heck is cytokinesis? What's a good way to talk about cytokinesis? It's when, right, the parent cell finally starts to divide into two daughter cells, and the cytoplasm, think specifically cytoplasm, now gets separated into two daughter cells. The chromosomes have already split apart, but cytokinesis is when the mitochondria and cytosol and endoplasmic reticulum and everything else starts to separate into two daughter cells. And for this class, just remember that as taking place during telophase. Some cells, under certain conditions, it might happen in metaphase or anaphase, but we're not going to be concerned with that in this class. All right, so I do want you to be able to recognize these different phases. Okay, so here is a good example right here. Here are some really fancy micrographs. Pretty big magnification. I don't think you've ever seen a nucleus this big when you look underneath a microscope. It almost fills a whole field of view right here. So this is a lot of magnification, but what's really cool about these slides right here is that a special dye was used. There is a dye that fluoresces blue when you shine ultraviolet light on it. You can't see ultraviolet light. As a matter of fact, it's pretty harmful to be around. It can cause mutations, and it can cause burns in the retina. So it's a special kind of microscope that shines the ultraviolet light only on the specimen. So the genetic material fluoresces blue, and then the microtubules and microfilaments fluoresce different colors, like yellow and green, maybe red, something like that in here, so we can see microtubules. And we can't see any of the other organelles, but we can infer what the shape of the cell looks like by just looking at the fluorescence of the background microfilaments. All right, so this is interphase. I don't see any condensed chromatin. This chromatin is being used for transcription to make proteins. Right, so I just see a nice homogeneous color right here. The nuclear envelope can be clearly defined to be in this region. And then I see some centrioles, a pair of centrioles right here. And remember, what's the job of the centrioles? They control the microfilaments and the microtubule, where they go and how they operate. Okay, first phase, prophase. Extended chromatin condenses, so now you can see some chromosomes inside the nucleus. You see some structures, the beginning of some structures inside the nucleus right here. A little bit later in prophase, the centrioles have split apart completely to opposite poles of the cell, and the nuclear envelope is completely gone, and all of the chromatin is condensed, and it forms chromosomes. But if I look at where the chromosomes are, it's just a random arrangement. I don't see any kind of order in the chromosomes whatsoever. But the chromosomes have attached themselves to the spindle apparatus, which are the microtubules that go across from each of these centrioles right here. And it's the job of these little monorails right here to push and pull the chromosomes and move them around inside the cell so they line up right at the equator of the cell. Right, and when they line up right at the equator of the cell, then we call that metaphase. So here I can see all the chromosomes in the middle of the cell, the microtubules between the centrioles forming the spindle apparatus, and then right after they arrange right at the center of the cell, the chromosomes, the replicated chromosomes, start to split apart during anaphase. All right, and then the very last phase, telophase, the chromosomes are pulled as far apart as possible, and the cells start to pinch apart, forming this cleavage furrow right here. That's a depression, and then that signals the beginning of cytokinesis, and the cytoplasm gets pinched into two daughter cells, and the chromosomes, of course, have already been separated. And the nuclear envelope starts to rebuild itself, and after the nuclear envelope is rebuilt, then these chromosomes, which are in a condensed form, can go back to an extended form, and can be used to initiate transcription for protein synthesis. So when DNA is in a condensed form like a chromosome right here, it can't be used to make a protein. Transcription cannot take place because the chromatin is wound around too many proteins. It can't be activated for transcription. Okay, but at least it's in a safe mode, can't be damaged when it's in a chromosome. All right, so that's mitosis, and don't forget cytokinesis takes place during telophase, which is the very last phase of mitosis. And what's one good reason for mitosis? Growth. Yeah, to get big. Okay, and then to replace old and damaged cells. In lab, you look at blood today underneath a microscope, and one of the funny things about blood, it has a couple different kinds of cells. It's got red blood cells and white blood cells. And if you look close at a red blood cell, you notice that it does not even have a nucleus. It's a special kind of cell that's completely filled up with a chemical called hemoglobin, which carries oxygen in our blood. That's the big job of a red blood cell. And there's not even room for a nucleus, because then you'd have to get some hemoglobin out of the cell. But because it doesn't have a nucleus, it can't repair itself. Right, it can't undergo transcription, can't undergo translation, so it can't rebuild proteins that it needs. So a red blood cell is easily damaged, and when it is, it can't recover, so it dies. So red blood cells only live for about 120 days. And then it's recycled, it's broken down, but you don't become anemic right away when all those red blood cells die, okay? And what's that condition called when you start to run low on red blood cells? That's anemia, okay? And remember in lab, how many red blood cells do we lose every second just because they can't repair themselves? They don't have a nucleus. You lose about 2 million red blood cells every second. So in order for you not to become anemic, what does your body have to do? It's got to build 2 million red blood cells every second through this process of mitosis right here. Okay? So that's how important mitosis is to replace old and damaged cells. So even though you're sleeping all night long, every 2 seconds, how many red blood cells did your body make? Millions, which means billions of red blood cells, right? Every time you fall asleep, your body has to build. So mitosis in us is very important, and that's just one tissue. Many tissues in your body turn over, certainly not as rapidly as that. Like your bones turn over about every 5 years, and there are living cells inside your bones. So every 5 years, you have a completely new skeleton. So mitosis certainly is important for most tissues in the body. About the only tissue that doesn't turn over or regenerate itself rapidly like that is neurons in the central nervous system. There is some growth in the brain and spinal cord, but not just very much, and it's tightly regulated, it's highly regulated. It's very hard to get those cells to reproduce by mitosis or any other kind of means of doing that. Okay, so that's it. But let's see, when's the first test in here? Guess what? I didn't download the syllabus in here. But I'm interested in taking a look at the syllabus. Do I have the syllabus here? So I want to look at syllabus fall. Oh, look what I have right here. So I must have logged on to Blackboard. I showed you all how to log on to Blackboard and then right-click to get it. So let's take a look at the syllabus. Is it spring? Yeah, that's it right here. So let's take a look at the schedule of classes. So we did orientation, cells on Wednesday, cells today. So next time we're going to move on to tissues. So we'll have at least one lecture on tissues before the practicum. Then, right, a week from today, we're going to get another lecture on tissues and the lab practicum for the Monday group. All right, so we're pretty much on schedule. So do your pre-lecture reading assignment for tissues. And let's see, the deadline for online quizzes is tomorrow at 11 p.m., and there's going to be one quiz on orientation and another quiz on cells. Maybe a little bit of tissues, maybe the first part of the tissues chapter. Okay, so go ahead and read the description in Blackboard. And hopefully you all have your materials. You have your textbook, and you have your lab manual. And if you bought a new textbook, you get the access code, so you can get the electronic version of the textbook through Blackboard onto your computer, even your mobile devices. Okay, you can look at your textbook. Okay, sign-in sheet was important for today. Okay, on the practicum, see if this is still working. On the practicum, it's going to be anything in unit number 1, which is labs number 1 and lab number 2. Okay, so it's listed in the lab manual. That's the easiest way. And then I can go over each item if you want to go over it. If you have lab this week, I'll go over it with you. Okay?